Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Workers' Mic on 720 WGN. We're powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor. I'm Ed Maher. Ken is out today, but today we've got co-host Phil Davidson from the Mid-America Regional Council of Carpenters. Welcome, Phil, and good morning.
Good morning, Ed. Thank you for having me here.
It is a pleasure to have you. And we're also going to have a special guest in the studio with us for the entire show, and that is Chicago Federation of Labor President Bob Ryder. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Ed. What's happening, Phil? How you doing?
Bob, always a pleasure.
Always good to have you in here, Bob. So, Phil, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about what you do and a little bit about what the carpenters are up to these days.
Absolutely. I am, good morning. I am the communications director for the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. We are 52,000 members across Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and Eastern Iowa. We do everything from commercial, industrial, residential, you name it. As Gary likes to say, our EST, from dirt to drapes. Some stuff we got going on lately is we're real excited about our new television show, Built to Last, which will be airing beginning in March.
And you've had a few seasons of that. That show's been on the air for a few years now, right?
Correct. I should say you're right. This is our new season, not a new show. We're going on season 8, but this year we are happy to report that we will be airing on Chicago's very own WGN, obviously a valued partner.
That's what we call a cross promotion.
You like that? Thank
Nicely
you.
Nicely done.
Thank you. I'm getting an extra bonus check for that. But so we'll be starting in March, and we'll be featuring stories about all the incredible work that our union members are doing across not only Illinois in Chicago, but across the rest of our jurisdiction. So tune in for that in Q1 of next year, and you'll be hearing plenty about it on this show, in our advertising, and elsewhere.
That's awesome. Thanks, Phil. And I've watched that show since it started, and we had a few of our members, I think, focused on that or featured on that from Local 150 a few years ago. It's a great show. I'd recommend everybody get out there, and you can watch the old episodes and learn an awful lot about what the trades have to offer, and some of the stories of people who've come from, you know, not knowing what their career was going to look like, joining the trades, getting into the carpenters or one of the other trades, going through the apprenticeship and starting to have a career. It's a lot of great stories, and I couldn't recommend it more highly. So Built to Last, check it out. Coming to our very own WGN TV.
That's good news. Yeah, we're doing plugs early today.
How about it?
Yeah.
What about you, Bob? What's going on with you?
Well, coming back to Built to Last, I'm going to tell you, Phil, that show is so good, and hang on, stick with me on this. You know, I was on Built to Last as one, you know, for a couple segments over the years, and every time I was on Built to Last, my wife's phone would start blowing up because her cousin or her aunt or some random family member or friend would be like, hey, I saw Bob on TV on Sunday morning. And it's like, what, you know, as long as I'm on TV because I'm not walking into a courthouse, it's a good day.
That's right. That's right. They call that the Carpenters Union bump. People know you. So yeah, it's great. We'll get you on. We'll get you on again.
I'm not fishing for a segment.
I got obvious what you're doing here, Bob.
You, yeah. The show really is something like one of those staples, I think, it became of Sunday morning television. I remember when I was a kid, you know, the different staples of Sunday morning television, you know, when, you know, before, as you work your way into football, or, you know, Ed's a big ice dancing fan, you know, before you get
huge,
into
right. huge.
Yeah, before you get into those afternoons of that. But but seriously, the Carpenter's Show Built to Last, which features a lot of different unions, I really do think it's something remarkable that you guys have done, and it's not just because you guys are a proud member of the CFL. I do think it's been pretty cool.
Thank you very much.
As we always say, we are our own best kept secret, unions, that is. And just like we try to do on this show, the Carpenters have been doing it for several years with Built to Last, just telling all kinds of stories of every type of worker in every type of situation. And, the results are, you can see them, you can hear them. When people see the show, they'll say, you know, I didn't know that union workers did that, or I didn't know that unions offered that. And these are all things that people are interested in, whether it's healthcare, training, safety, you know, just a louder voice at work. So hats off to you guys for the work that you've done on that.
Hey, and for a market demographic in terms of who you want to reach, you know, if you're an advertiser or a local network, I got to be honest with you, if this last election didn't prove it, working people's a target demographic for anybody.
Oh, for sure.
1,000%, yeah.
I mean, like, take, for example, the Workers' Rights Amendment, which we've talked a lot about on here, but it performed better than every statewide candidate of any party in every single county in Illinois. So workers are bigger than politics, and workers vote. So I couldn't agree more with you, Bob. If this most recent election taught us anything in Illinois, it's that you want to be on the side of workers and, you know, doing things like trying to slash wages or push, you know, now banned right-to-work laws is just not a winning, it's not a good policy, but more than ever, it's bad politics.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And you know what, Ed? As you guys know, we see it out on the street every day, right? Right. And people are, I know, people are organizing unions, and people are standing up for their rights, just from A to Z. Whether, you know, I'm, you know, we had a Starbucks rally this week. I know you guys probably have talked about Starbucks ad nauseum, but the, you know, there was a, you know, a rally out at the airport this past Thursday with airport workers, and it's the amazing thing about what we do here in Chicago. You know, my organization represents all the majority of unions in Chicago, but it's really like representing communities. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I tell people, any, you know, you can alternate like which trade you put in there, but everybody knows, knows a carpenter, right? Everyone knows a teacher, an electrician, someone, you know, so someone knows, you know, hey, the guy who's the person on the Metro train who takes my ticket, you know, the conductors, they're union members. And Ed, fun fact.
I love fun facts.
Oh yeah,
let's hear it.
We all
be a good one.
We all have deep roots into the labor movement. I know that I have. You know, I come. My family comes from the operating engineers. I have family members that are in AFSCME. My sister was a union teacher. But you know who else has a web of union connections?
Tell me.
It's the guy sitting between you and me right now, Phil Davidson.
That's right.
My co-host, Phil Davidson. Well, yeah. Let's hear more about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some, some union blood in my extended family. I've got a wife who works for the teachers union. I've got a brother-in-law who works for the Transportation Communications Union, who Bob is friendly with. I've got another brother who works for BMWED, another railroad union. A father-in-law who was a local chairman for the Signalmen. The list goes on. Okay. So yeah, there's some real ties there.
And his in-laws, they also connect. The Shanahans also connect back right to the Carpenters Union too.
Yes, there's members in the. It's a large clan. It's a large Southside Irish clan. So yes,
let me ask you this, Phil. Yeah. We talked last week about the contract that was imposed on rail workers, you know, by Congress and the Biden administration, and a lot of folks in these rail unions were not happy about that.
Yep.
It didn't include the sick days that they were looking for. Have you heard a lot about that? It sounds like you have a lot of family in.
Yeah, that comes up at the dinner table conversations. You know, there was, as you guys are aware, I'm not sure if all listeners are, but there was a bit of a divide amongst the different rail unions when it came to approving that contract. Some were on board with it, some weren't.
Right.
And actually, in my family, there was a split of one of the unions supported, one of them didn't. But, you know, I think everyone, you know, ultimately can agree that let's get people sick days. It's not we're not going too far out on a limb to ask that workers receive days wages for when they're sick and when they need to plan for you know, both themselves and their children.
Right.
So I think you know, but the rail unions, they're a different breed in that there's so many and there's different factions.
Yeah, I would say there were more than a dozen unions that were party to that agreement.
More than a dozen,
maybe 14.
Right.
And they all supported adding the sick days in the federal legislation.
Yes.
Right, because that was something they all wanted. Not, you know, it wasn't part of the deals that got ratified by the ones who ratified an agreement. It wasn't because they didn't want it. It's because, you know, you're dealing with a really bad group of employers,
right?
And these, when you look at where they were at in bargaining, and you know the whole structure around rail labor is different than most of the other sectors, right? Like when people think of unions, they think of what you know as private sector unions,
right,
which are under the National Labor Relations Act, or public sector unions, which are your, you know, your librarians, your teachers, your police officers, your firemen.
Yeah, they all people who work for governmental agencies.
Right. And they all have different rules, but the ones that most people are the traditional private sector unions and the public sector unions here in Illinois. But the rail labor unions, they live under a completely different set of rules.
Yep.
And the airline unions fall under most of the Rail Labor Act, but even they have then differences. Mm-hmm. And here's what I'll tell you. I once got in trouble, almost got in trouble with this because I was on a radio show, and I advocated, you know, if the employers like these labor bargaining acts because they've been able to, after they were passed, they didn't like it, but then they wanted to like sort of zero in on it. So I proposed, you know what? If they wanna limit what we do because they think it impacts them, how about this? How about we get rid of it all?
Get rid of the rules and just hit the streets
They don't like the rules as written now. We don't like the rules as written now. Let's just get rid of it.
Blow it up.
Yeah, and then I was like, well, you know what? Have you checked in with everybody on that yet? But I'm like, well, maybe there are some things, some parts of the dynamic. Like
ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these, as we said on the show, the rail workers.
I think it wouldn't benefit the whole country and the stability of labor relations, but I do think if we started from scratch here in Chicago, we'd have a lot of fun, and I think worker power would be on the agenda.
It would be memorable. Stability is important, but it would not be boring. That's for sure. We've got to take a break, but we're going to be back talking about some more actions that have been taken recently by essential workers. So stay with us. We'll be right back with you here on the Workers' Mic, 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ed Maher. I'm here with co-host Phil Davidson and our special guest, CFL President Bob Ryder. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about essential workers. And over the past week, there were a couple of cases of different transportation workers that are also essential who've taken action. Just this past Thursday at Logan Airport in Boston, there were 50 people who clean out planes and deliver the ramps to the side of planes, and they did a one-day strike just to show everybody what happens when they don't come to work. They're not super highly paid, but they called this one-day strike just to remind people about how important their work is and what happens when they don't show up. So, I think this is something we're talking about one-day strikes and people trying to work outside the confines of federal labor law. So I think that little small things like this remind people. I mean, we also had a one-day strike this week by New York Times employees, I think more than 1,000 of them. But Bob, I mean, what do you think about this kind of popping up outside of the traditional, you know, contract expires, can't get a new one, go on strike? These one-day kind of almost like wildcat strikes.
Well, they're not. Sometimes they're wildcat strikes. Sometimes they're intermittent strikes that happen after an agreement expires.
Right.
And wildcat strikes are not sanctioned by the union because they usually occur during the course of an existing collective bargaining agreement. So they're unsanctioned actions because the workers on the ground are just completely fed up. Uh-huh. But I will mention that we had our own little airport action yesterday, and it wasn't little, actually. It had to do with Swissport, which is a cargo carrier for companies like Amazon, and they actually had a one-day strike on Thursday as well. What this tells you is that people are fed up with getting screwed with, right? The Swissport workers, again, they're...
Was that a wildcat strike?
Yeah, that was a wildcat strike as well. I mean, there was an action that popped up around it. Well, the Swissport workers don't have a union. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, there's a lot of middle class jobs that can be better. There's a lot of jobs that people in the working poor in that can be better. And all that needs to happen is that big companies like Amazon, who bring in these non-union companies who help feed off of working people, they need to recognize from the top to the bottom that there's dignity in work, right, and that if you want to be in a consumer-based society, which the United States is a consumer-based society, you have to have consumers. So let people, you know, whether it's Swissport, Amazon, or anybody else, pay people fairly. Right. Let them go. Let them have bathroom breaks.
Yes.
You know, being able to go home to go to bed might be nice.
Right. So. I mean, I assume you're talking about Twitter. San Francisco is actually cracking down on Twitter. They, you know, they fired anybody who wasn't willing to work around the clock, it seems. And so now they've actually installed like barracks inside their office so that people can sleep there. They get off, they get done coding or just code until they can't stay awake anymore, sleep for a few hours and get back to work. And this is something that Elon Musk is touting as a winning business model.
I can tell you, if anybody at Twitter wanted to know, I could have warned him, because not only is he anti-worker, and that's sort of revealed itself.
Yeah, making him sleep at the office, I think, is really underscores that. Yeah.
But he's viscerally anti-union too. Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Going back, you know, with the workers who build Tesla cars.
Right.
Yeah, I read something interesting about him recently that posited that maybe Elon Musk is actually just dumb. When you look at some of his different propositions and you know, everything from with the when he tried to rescue the coal miners,
oh my gosh,
and when that blew up, and then you know, then he accused the guy who criticized that plan as being a child molester,
right?
And then, you know, he's starting fights with senators, the people who regulate his business, you know, trying to fly cars in space. There's just a lot of examples of stuff that, sure, we all think he's, you know, some sort of genius, but I look at him more as a very ambitious guy,
right?
But like, the thought process behind what he's doing.
I'm gonna disagree with you for a second. Okay. And I don't wanna upset I don't wanna upset a whole segment of the audience that you guys have here today. But I do think that when he got those hair plugs put in, that somehow that may have, you know, hit the synapses in his brain, and maybe that's what it's all about.
Seems more plausible.
Yeah, right. That's an interesting theory. We're gonna have to flesh that one out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the
we'll get to that right after we have the debate over whether a Chicago hot dog is a sandwich.
There's a hot debate to be had there.
I got one question about, do consumers bear any of the blame for the problems that workers are having, in that we've become such a spoiled society where we expect everything to be just dirt cheap? You know, like a flat screen television now costs $300.
Right. It's a very good
And that's
question.
Our expectation.
Because, well, I mean, anymore, if you're Christmas shopping and you want to buy something, if it takes more than 2 days to get delivered to your house, that's abnormal for a lot of people now.
Yep.
And to make that happen, it requires an awful lot of people to be working night shifts, to be, you know, working sort of lower wage warehouse jobs and things like that. So the cost of those low priced items, I mean, beyond offshoring a lot of the electronics production, I think the last TV company that existed in the United States was Zenith, and it went out of business because they couldn't keep up with the prices of Sony's and Panasonic's and things like that.
Ed, I think the one thing that you have to keep in mind is, are workers complicit in it? Like, are consumers complicit in it? Like Phil's positing.
Mm-hmm.
They're both complicit and victims of it.
For sure.
Right? And especially low-wage workers, because they end up becoming dependent on costs being so low on certain items because of their wages. And then when inflation hits, because the economy's twisted inside out and upside down, then those people are still getting paid lower wages and everything goes up. Now, the thing that's been happening that hasn't fully played out is the uprising in the with workers not being satisfied with how they're being treated that we're seeing happen in this moment,
which is exciting.
Yeah, I think people are starting to open their eyes to it. Stay with us right here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back with the Workers' Mic.
You're listening to the Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back to the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ed Maher, here with co-host Phil Davidson, special guest Bob Ryder. I wanted to, you know, in the first segment of the show, we were talking a little bit about everybody's background, and Bob was talking about how he's from, you know, the far south side out by Lockport. But I want to talk to you guys.
I never actually said that. Ed, are you trying? Here he is again, putting words in my mouth.
Well, anyway, so Bob, you represent workers all over the city. You tend to work as many as 1 to 2 days a week, from what I understand. Phil, I know you're all over the city as well. So I want to throw something out here for a topic of conversation. For working people, what is the best lunch in the city of Chicago? My take, I'll give up my take first, and that is Al's Italian Beef, the original Al's number one Italian Beef on Taylor Street, where you can't sit down, you got the elbows on the counter. That's the top of the mountain for me. I'm curious.
The Italian Beef Stance, I think it's called.
Yeah, you got to widen up your feet a little bit.
Right.
It's no joke.
Well, I mean, so this is a little bit more complex for me because, you know, I can't eat the standard American Chicagoan lunch anymore. But I don't want to promote that because there's definitely a lot of cholesterol bubbling up the Chicago River. But I will tell you, all those rules aside, Ed, I would have to say the Italian beef with sweet peppers. And as my wife's family would say from because they're Northsiders, the Northside Italians, they'd say mozzarella.
Yeah, where from? Where do you go?
Well, being someone from the southwest side, our you know, my place was actually Pop's Beef.
Pops, yeah. Of course,
I knew it was Pops. Gonna be Pops.
Yeah, it's Pops. You know, they have the perfect French fry. Their beef is you know good and soaked. And you know if you have a day where, you know, it's like, I can't do beef today, you can always slide over to a hot dog wrapped in fries. Now, the important ingredient, and this is critical, this is the most important piece, no matter what Italian beef stand or hot dog stand you're eating at in Chicago or the greater Chicagoland area, it has to be Vienna beef. Probably made on the south side now. Used to be on the north side, but probably made on the south side now by...
You're not supposed to take sides. You're supposed to represent everybody, Bob.
Yeah, but I will tell. Well, hey, okay. So I'm not.
That's
so,
good union beef right there.
Yeah. Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah. UFCW Local 1546
right.
members who make who prepare Vienna beef, Italian beef, and hot dogs.
The best beef you're going to find, Phil. Let's hear. What do you think?
This is difficult because, as you know, I'm sponsored by several retailers in the Chicagoland area, and I don't want to have to play sides here, but. And I mean, is this an Italian beef question
just
now?
Lunch.
Because
this
we're both.
Lunch. I mean, we're,
it's two votes for Italian beefs right now. Maybe to play devil's advocate, I'll say the Italian at JP Graziano's is a pretty darn good lunch.
I couldn't agree more with you on that. I mean, Graziano's is outstanding. A lot of people don't know about that. Right over in Fulton Market.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, no, for sure. Depending on what time of the day and what day of the week.
Yeah,
it used to be for me, the Italian beef selection from where you get it could be different. Like if it was a Friday night on the southwest side during the summer back in the day, it would be from Duke's Drive-In on Harlem Avenue.
Okay.
You know, Duke's is now moved down the southwest side because you can go there, get an Italian beef combo, because that's better for dinner, right? You take a piece of Italian sausage and put it inside of the Italian beef, right? Good for the heart.
Yep.
Good for the heart. Cleans the system out.
Well, Bob, I hope you've been listening to some of the life insurance providers that we've had on the show recently, because it sounds like you should have a nice big policy. So one thing I wanted to bring up, and this is something that came up over the past week, a lot of people across the city and across the country have been watching the World Cup. You know, once every 4 years, people sort of try to take an interest and understand soccer again. But the U.S. men's team, you know, hats off to them. They did a great job. They got out of the first round and lost their game in the round of 16. But if you remember, there was a pay dispute with the U.S. women's national team where they felt that they weren't getting equal pay because, you know, frankly, the men's team hasn't been competitive on a global stage for many, many years, while the women's team is like the 96-97 Chicago Bulls. They've just been mopping the floor with everybody for the last 20 years. And
dominant.
Yeah, not walking away with a lot to show for it. So they negotiated a new collective bargaining agreement that wrapped up earlier this year, I think in February, where basically all World Cup prize money was going to be distributed evenly among the teams. So by getting out of the group stage and into the knockout stage of the World Cup, the U.S. men's national team is guaranteed at least a $13 million bonus, and the ladies are going to get half of that, which I think is fantastic. They deserve it. They're outstanding players, but it was kind of an interesting place that unions popped up in the national news over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Women's soccer in particular, they're the Women's Soccer Professional Soccer League has a union, and they recently got their first collective bargaining agreement. Their campaign was organized around the hashtag No More Side Hustles, because if you look at the WNBA, you look at women's soccer, those players are have to go and play in other leagues, yep, in other countries in order to scrape by a living if they want to stay competitive for their main gig,
right,
in the U.S. Professional League, right? Because unlike a lot of men's sports where they have the ability to do off-season training because they make enough to stay training through the rest of the year, in order to keep that high level of play, they have to keep playing. Right. Right, they just literally have to keep playing.
And I've even seen some professional women's athletes on Instagram talking about side jobs, like waitressing, when they're not in season, which is incredible. Yeah,
I don't know if you guys saw this last week, but going back to soccer, one of the world's sort of like biggest stars in soccer, Cristiano Ronaldo, he's been kind of a fading star in the European leagues, but he signed a deal with a Saudi Arabian team for $211 million per year.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, $211 million per year. I mean, Saudi Arabia is making a big splash with money in golf. I mean, they've owned a lot of, you know, soccer teams and like Formula One, like all that. They've been using sport as a marketing tool.
Yeah,
because sports washing.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, because otherwise people don't want to come to their country or invest in it because of all the regressive laws and that they have in Saudi Arabia. So, like Phil just said, they're sport washing their culture in order to attract you know, American and European money into their country.
Right.
Yeah, the people of Saudi Arabia must be thrilled with seeing their money going to Cristiano Ronaldo.
I know.
If you look at like the facilities that went up in Qatar for the World Cup, a lot of it was done at the expense of the workers who built those facilities, and a ridiculous amount of money was spent. I mean,
they didn't finish, right? A lot of the
the amenities either for guests. They built, you know, was it eight stadiums?
Right. I mean, Qatar has a population of citizens who live there. It's around 300,000. They have about 3 million people living there in total, but 90% of them are expats or migrant workers. And recently, with building all these stadiums, it's been a lot of migrant workers, because you're talking about a country that has one big city in it, and around that one big city they had to build 8 NFL style stadiums, which is insane. And you are 100% right, Bob, because in say the Russian Olympics, there were like a dozen workers who died building those facilities, and the world was upset about this. In Qatar, it was 6,500 migrant workers died building stadiums and getting prepared. 6,500, that's not a typo. That's a real number of people just working, building stadiums in 120-degree heat in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm. So on different projects that I've been involved with like public buildings that have gone up, that have been built, and have been built, union built, modestly built, with definitely taxpayers got their value. But the people who were bidding on the jobs, they would send the architects would send their lookbooks along, and you know, some of them would include these elaborate buildings that were built in the Middle East with no budget, right? Like they're built with no budget, with an endless amount of money, but they're not being built where they're raising middle class wages for their workers, right? It's like the complete exploitation of workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Safe to say Qatar is not a union town.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not even close. All right, well, we've got to take a quick break, but we will be back in a few minutes. Stay with us on the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.
You're listening to the Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premis Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back to the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. Ed Maher here with Phil Davidson and our special guest with a capital S, Bob Ryder. So one of the things that we alluded to earlier in the show, there was a one-day strike this past Thursday, and I think it leaked into Friday, at the New York Times, of all places. They've been trying to get a new contract, I think, for about a year and a half. At issue is wages and a handful of other things. And I know, Phil, you've been watching this, and what are your thoughts, or what was the latest on that?
Well, I have special interest in it just because I was a former journalist myself, and want to stand with the Times journalists, and I am a fairly loyal Times reader. But I think the strikes began last night, and it's a 24-hour strike, so no listening to the Daily this morning, the podcast, and no checking my Times newsletters that I get. It's the media landscape has really changed, as everyone knows, to state the obvious. And the New York Times is one of the very few news organizations in the world that are that is thriving. I mean, it was, I will tip my hat to them, a pretty genius investment to purchase Wordle and all these other games now, and then they kind of spin those off separately. So, like, they're very profitable right now, and the cost of living in New York City, as we know, is astronomical.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, with all the profits that they're turning right now, it's time to give these guys a fair deal. I don't think they're asking for a whole lot. It's been, as you said, a year and a half since they've had a contract there. So, yeah, standing with solidarity and hope they can come through and take care of these guys.
So, Phil, I think we got to ask Ed this one question. Ed, are you familiar with Wordle?
I am familiar with Wordle.
Do you ever play Wordle?
I don't post it on Facebook like you do every day, but I do play it.
I only post it on Facebook when I get two.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Which is never.
Do you know, they bought that for $1 million. They paid for that, and yeah. It's like the most downloaded game ever.
Yeah.
You know, so like thinking of how much they're making off Wordle alone.
So Ed, are you interrupting your Wordle streak for the strike?
I don't play Wordle on a daily basis, but I typically do listen to, you know, the Daily almost every day. I read the New York Times, but yes, I do play Wordle on a fairly regular basis, and I always start off with the word clear. That's my word. Do you have a word, Bob?
I do.
What is it?
I do. I don't know if I want to share it.
All right. Well, but moving right along. How about you, Phil? Do you have a word? Are you into the Wordle? Do you play the Wordle?
I play. I got bored with it because I was just so good at it. You know, I had like a 200-day winning streak, 100%, obviously. So, my start word was alert.
Alert.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Alert.
Well, it certainly wasn't humble.
Is that six letters?
Whatever.
My starting word is close to Phil's. It's meant.
Meant?
Yeah.
Why would you not share that? Is this like a secret? You're not competing against the listeners.
Well, you know.
Are you in the world rankings?
I'm competing against my mom and sister. My mom and sister share their start word all the time.
Two on one?
Yeah.
Say it one more time. Meant?
Meant. M-E-A-N-T.
Spelled it right. That's an extra point.
Pretty good.
My word is similar to the R-S-T L, N, and E from Wheel of Fortune.
I started out with that also. You know, one of the things that I read about this New York Times strike, that the Times had an issue. The union that represents the writers, I think it's just the New York Guild or the Times Guild.
But, part of the CWA News Guild.
Yeah.
Yep, right.
So one of the issues that the Times had was that negotiations, they said, were not productive because the Times they didn't agree to closed-door negotiations. They had negotiations over Zoom with a large group of negotiators, but then also I think 200 and some observers, people who were watching the negotiations. And the Guild does this in the name of transparency. I mean, I know that, you know, having been in the environment of union negotiations many times, often the deals are done and completed in the wee hours of the morning in a hallway when there's just a small handful of people getting down to the main issues. So, you know, Bob, I know that you've dealt with, you know, various unions across the city, and you've probably seen outcomes of negotiations from large groups and then outcomes of negotiations from bigger groups. I don't know if it would be 200, but what are your thoughts? And I guess Phil also at the Carpenters, you know, is, which way have you guys historically gone? I mean, it's gotta be hard to negotiate a contract in front of a crowd of hundreds of people.
Not necessarily. It depends on the culture of the union and how the union's structured. Some unions have a structure where there's a council that's over a bunch of different locals, so the constituents are more tiered. Then you have some mega locals that have a lot of workplaces, and they have big committees because they have so many constituents that need to weigh in. But there's always sidebars. The key to it all, whether you have a small committee or a large committee, is maintaining that level of transparency with your members,
right,
and communicating to the employer that if you want a deal ratified, I can work with you to get to terms, but it has to be something that my members can ratify at the end of the day. Because if I can't ratify this deal, it doesn't do you any good, employer. And sometimes there's some benefit to having people in there. There's no right or wrong way to do,
yeah,
it, as long as there's transparency with the members when you get down to it, when it comes time to be ratifying and walk through the agreement.
For sure. Members have to know what the goals are. I mean, anything like this has got to be driven by the members, what their needs are. And a union that negotiates contracts that aren't based on what they're hearing from their members, I mean, that's not a successful strategy for a strong union that's going to have a lot of support.
Bob, do you represent the Chicago Tribune Guild?
So the Chicago Tribune Guild is part of the Chicago News Guild, which is an affiliate of the CFL.
So the answer to that, a long yes?
Yeah, it's a long yes, but I want, you know, the but they're under their first contract.
Yep.
So it's we represent the guild in their workplaces. We work with them very closely, but sometimes people don't understand what the structure is and then how people get brought into the bigger labor movement. We are always there on the front lines as a new groups getting organized to assist our affiliates in doing that.
Yeah, that was a welcome development when they organized. I know it's been a couple years now, like back, because it was still when they were under Tronc, right, before they were bought by Eldon. But with everything we've seen with this Eldon Capital and what they've done to newspapers, I think it's safe to say without that union, who knows what the Tribune would even be anymore.
I will say this. The Tribune, for many, many, many years, was not a friendly news outlet for workers.
Colonel McCormick was about as anti-union as it comes.
Right. It was very anti-worker. Yeah. And then they got bought by a company that basically squeezed everyone out and said, we can hire monkeys to sit at typewriters and do your job, so you're getting paid nothing. And then all these journalists said, oh, man, we need a union. I will say the Tribune has become a lot less abrasive toward workers, but... But you know, we saw what it took.
Well, so Tronc, which owned the Tribune, also tried to acquire the Chicago Sun-Times, and we should probably disclose this, that some of the members of the Midwest Coalition of Labor, along with the Chicago Federation of Labor, put together a deal with some other investors to buy the Chicago Sun-Times from the ownership group that was in place at the time. And in full transparency, I ended up back representing the labor movement with the Chicago Reader, which originally was part of the Sun-Times, got spun off, and now is a not-for-profit. And the Sun-Times itself is now a not-for-profit owned by public radio media or whatever. But the carpenters and the operating engineers and the laborers union and SEIU and some others, the insulators union, were all part of the ownership group, the Chicago Sun-Times, for a two and a half, three-year period. I don't know the exact time frame anymore.
That's right, yeah.
So
we're getting near the end of our time. We've got to wrap up, and I want to thank both of you guys for being here. Phil, it's been a pleasure having you. I think you're going to be back next week with Ken, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thanks for having me. How did it feel to be able to get a word in edgewise in this show?
You know, I didn't know what to do with all the open air. We miss you, Ken. We've got to wrap up. Thanks for hanging out with us. We will be back with you next week. So thanks for listening. This has been the Workers' Mic, powered by MCL, right here on 720 WGN.
The preceding episode of The Workers' Mic was powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial. For additional information and podcasts of The Workers' Mic, visit WGNRadio.com.